Welcome to the Unsweetened SIO podcast. My name is Siobhan Harris. I am a certified integrative nutrition health coach and the founder of unsweetenedsio.com. I gave up all sugar and all flour on January 13th, 2018, and am finally free of my addiction. My mission is to help other sugar addicts find their path to freedom and live the sweet life without sugar.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 160 of Unsweetened SIO, the podcast. Really excited to have back some familiar guests today. Clarissa and Molly are both certified mental health and addiction clinicians who have over 20 years combined experience working in the field. For the past 3 years, they have been in private practice working with clients one-on-one towards treatment for food addiction while continuing their studies and doing research in the field of treatment on food addiction. In January 2021, they partnered with Dr. Vera Tarman to launch the Food Junkies podcast, which now has over 300,000 downloads. Later that year, they began the first ever clinical research audit on ultra-processed food addiction treatment and recently published their findings in a research paper in Frontiers in Psychiatry called Low Carbohydrate and Psychoeducational Programs Show Promise for the Treatment of Ultra-Processed Food Addiction. This paper is now in the top 2% of papers ever published in Frontiers and top 100 papers published of all time in the online journal. In November, so later this month, Molly and Clarissa are soft launching Sweet Sobriety, an interactive online food addiction recovery community. This online platform will include enhanced food addiction treatment modules based on their published research paper, groups, one-on-one coaching, monthly workshops, and more. Wow, you guys have been busy. Welcome back, Clarissa and Molly.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Yes, we're happy to be here.
I'm so excited to talk about all of these things, but I want to first remind people, if you haven't listened, I've had Clarissa and Molly both on individually, and they've shared their own stories of recovery. Very, very powerful stories. So I will link those in the episode notes, but please go back and listen to get a little more background information on both of them. But what we're really here to talk about today is this research paper that they just published. And Molly, I think, is going to kick it off on how this idea even came to be to do this.
You know, and that's kind of a great question. And really, Jen Unwin and Heidi Yiver are probably the people to answer that. But here's what happened. Clarissa and I were designing an intense outpatient program, and I reached out to Jen to just say, hey, will you give a look at this and just let us know if you think we're on the right track? I've based it off of all my years of experience working with other substance use disorders, and this is what we would take somebody with methamphetamine use disorder or alcohol use disorder through in an IOP program or intense outpatient program, which means it's about 10 hours of programming. And she and Heidi reached back out and they were like, this is great, but we'd like for you to join us, or would you consider joining us in this program or this research that we are trying to get going with the public health collaboration in the UK? And when she said you, she meant Clarissa and myself. And I was like, well, let me get a hold of Clarissa and figure this out. And I mean, as soon as Clarissa and I chatted, of course, it was something we wanted to do. We just wanted to make sure that if, you know, that we were willing to put that program then that we were designing on hold at that time. And so we did. We said, all right, here we go. This is much more important because it's so right now, you know, it's needed. And we had hoped that it would help us really launch this idea or our efforts to get the diagnosis of ultra-processed food addiction in the DSM and the ICD. So we had hoped that if we could show that we could treat it and people improved or had similar outcomes to other substance use disorders, that it would give us another leg to stand on when we continued our pursuit in getting those diagnoses. So that's, I mean, that's kind of the short answer, but certainly Jen Unwin would know more about how they formulated that idea, but that's how we got involved.
Yeah. And that is brilliant because this research needs to be done, like you said, to get it the medically recognized. And then now you're able to use your findings to help treat people too. So it does seem like it was really good timing to do that right as you're about to launch this, outpatient program. So it has a pretty, I love the title. I was kind of laughing a little reading it. Low carbohydrate and psychoeducational program show promise for the treatment of ultra processed food addiction. Just a little mouthful there, but talk to us more about what that means and what the purpose maybe of the study was. Maybe let's start there.
Yeah, for sure. So when we were looking at, people coming in, we do know that self-determination is a huge motivator for people to do well. And so we certainly didn't assign a food plan to anyone. We helped them understand what a low exposure food plan would look like. And that was low carb. And for some people that included grains. And for some people that was, more carnivore based, whatever their needs were. We helped them identify, what is a trigger food for you? What do you mentally obsess about? What do cravings look like? We educated them. That psychoeducation piece is about what is food addiction, right? What is addiction in general? And then how does it affect us biologically, right? Biopsychosocial, spiritual. So we created a treatment program around that and recruited participants who would be willing just to, give it a try and see if things would improve. And obviously the results showed that their well-being after a 10-week intervention, their well-being went up, their food addiction symptoms went down, and their BMI went down as well, which is, when we look at the world of eating disorders, we don't even see positive outcomes like that. So it is very, very hopeful. And there would certainly be some individuals in this study who would also identify with having eating disorder, right? Whether it's bulimia or binge eating disorder. So it wasn't exclusive. However, we do know that binge eating disorder is, 42 to 87% correlated with food addiction. And bulimia is, up to 80-90% correlated. And so treating, removing that hedonic substance allows people to find recovery from the symptoms that they are experiencing. So we did, we would give them, in the first group, we did kind of a presentation first, then we had group after. And after that, we kind of realized that it would be better for them to have a pre-recorded session and then come to group and just do a 2-hour process group. And so that's what they did. And it was 10 weeks. We covered topics. So the first one was food addiction, mindful eating. We did abstinence and withdrawal. We did craving management. We did addiction interaction disorder. We did hope. We did unhelpful thinking styles, stress and spirituality, emotional eating, self-compassion, and then body image work as well. And so those were the modules. And, it was really amazing to see these individuals who'd never met before come together as a community and interact with each other and recover together. And so it was really a beautiful experience for us to see. And we did 8 groups.
And yeah, so I was going to back you up on how many. Yeah. So how many, back to the recruiting process, because I had seen that you posted, you were looking for individuals to sign up on Instagram. And I actually had a thought of, darn it, I wish I could have, where was that, a couple of years ago, I was like, man, this would have been such a lifeline. Just how lucky these participants were to actually do this and have this type of comprehensive, when you're listing all those modules and all those areas. I mean, most people don't get that right off the bat. right? Especially like you're talking about eating disorders. You know, I kept getting treatment for binge eating disorder, thinking that was my problem. And of course, treatment's moderation for that. So it wasn't helpful for me. So I really like feel like these people were so lucky to get this right off the bat. So yeah, talk a little bit about that process. And were there certain criteria people had to meet? And then what was your group? What did your group look like? How many people?
So the recruitment process was Clarissa and I chose to use social media as our recruitment. There were two other groups involved with this. So there was the group in the UK, Jen and Heidi, and then there was the group in Sweden, Charlotte and Frida, and they had their own recruitment process. We all had the same criteria though. We all had to use the same protocols, all of that, but we chose social media. So we posted it in the Facebook groups, Vera's Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life, I'm Sweet Enough, and Bitten's Facebook group, Sugar Bomb in Your Brain. We had it on Instagram. So we had it then on our own personal social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook pages, whatever it might be. Mostly what we were looking for is that people were self-identified as a food addict. They were over 18, they weren't pregnant. And that, you know, that they didn't have like a health provider or a mental health provider that would basically say, no, no way, don't do this. So our screening process then allowed, you know, so they had questionnaires that they had to fill out. And then we did up to a 30 minute phone call with folks, to make sure that they would be a good fit, you know, and that if there was anything that kind of lit up our, you know, gave us any red flags, that we encouraged more, conversations with other health providers, whatever it might be, in order to get in there. So then the groups were, I would love to say that they were more diverse than they were, but I think we had about one or two men who joined us. I think only one ever like completed the whole shebang, which is okay. I get it. It's probably a bit intimidating to show up to a Zoom room full of women and try to be vulnerable or identify or whatever. But we did try to get men to join us. So it was mostly, I would say it was mostly women, probably 35 plus on average in age. So some groups were, you know, some groups were 10 to 12 people. We had groups that were, 20 people or more. It just really all depended on that cycle that we were in and who was interested and who got involved. But just as Clarissa said, we had initially started the first group. We would show up in the first half of the group was we were giving education. And then the second half of the group was supposed to be like group work. And we found that it was just too overwhelming. People had a hard time transitioning from the education piece into like, okay, now you need to do the work. So when we started giving them the pre-recorded education and then they came to group ready to work, so they brought their assignments to share or they brought whatever, hey, this is the struggle I'm working on. The 2 hours flew, you know, people were doing work, like you could see it like just happening, you know, the light bulbs were going off and then they were using, you know, then we highly encouraged them to stay connected to one another. So there were multiple WhatsApp groups. We host a Facebook page for them, to continue to communicate. We stay involved. We can't do every single WhatsApp group that they have, but we have one main WhatsApp group, one main Facebook page that we stay involved. So if they had questions, they had to ask the questions to the group so that there was no like individual interaction, because then that might skew the results, right? So if you, Siobhan, had like reached out and said, hey, Molly, what about this on my food plan? I might say, you know, I would love to answer that question, but can you post it either in the WhatsApp group or the Facebook group so that I can answer that question so everybody has the benefit of that answer? So that's what we did for, you know, 10 weeks, multiple times. And we still meet with those folks today. We have monthly check-ins for 24 months following the completion, of their group. So, that group has now, you know, I would love to say that it's super large, but it's not. There's probably about 25 people that come each month. So it's, you know, it's an average sized group. And we can't, you know, we don't want to force people to come, but they're certainly welcome to come to the check-ins, the monthly check-ins, all that they want, but they can come, they can say, hey, this is how my month has been going. This is what's going better. This is what I'm still working on. They can ask questions. They can say, I'm just struggling. They also, you know, the folks that show up in that group typically are also pretty active in those other, you know, communication veins, the WhatsApp group, Facebook group, whatever it might be too. So I hope I answered all of those questions.
Yeah, that was great. Okay. So, and I'm just kind of trying to understand. So there, you said there was 8 total groups that you did?
I think we actually had seven. Yep.
Okay, so seven groups, somewhere between 10 to maybe more people, you know, in each group. And each of those groups went through the 10-week process. Wow. Yeah, I just want people to get how, again, comprehensive this study was. And yeah, like all, just all the thought and what went in it, into it. And I love that you adjusted as you kind of went along. So we're like,
I also think it might be important just to note that we certainly all, with every single group, we started with a larger amount. And, you know, like any addiction treatment, this is hard. And so people drop out, and there would be times where we recruited and maybe started with 40 and we ended up with 25. And that is just the way. It's not to say that, you know, to get people discouraged, but just to show that this is challenging, right? And this is also pretty universal when we do any addiction treatment. You're going to get those people that leave early, that are just not ready, that maybe they're just not motivated, or, you know, and then we did have people who, because of personal circumstances, dropped out of one group, but then joined us in another group as well.
Mm. Well, not even like, yeah, I'm curious to like what you found with people, I'm sure with your findings, like at how long people, what point they were starting to drop off, or did you see any kind of consistencies around that? Cause it is, it's so, so hard, even when you have, all the tools and support and education, you know, it's still so, so difficult.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed. Go ahead, Clarissa. Yeah.
I was just going to say, we didn't really notice any huge common themes between each group. We did notice that those that communicated well between group still seemed to do like really develop that community piece. What we also noticed is on some later trials, we did include some individuals who had some previous experience with recovery, some of our own clients. And when they were able to, because they'd already worked with us, we couldn't use their data, right? But they were in the group. They modeled this level of vulnerability that people were able to mirror. And we found that those progressed so much further when people were just willing to give in to the process and be honest about what was going on. And I think, again, it really, we want to highlight that we really tried to only talk about the food and the food plan week one, maybe a little in week two. Then, you know, that was really all left to them to figure out, because we'd given them the information. They might ask us a few random questions, but often we find in food addiction recovery, it's always about the food. And like, we know that that's not the truth. Recovery, like once you get abstinence, we know what to eat, right? We know what not to eat. We just need to help them build coping skills and a life that they don't need to escape from, so they go back to the food. And that's what treatment's about.
Yeah, so much isn't about the food, really. I mean, it's all the other things. And that sounds, again, with this, all the module topics you are listing, you go into all those areas that then like allow people to have that sustainability on their food plan. And I love that you weren't like, you have to do it. And I bet some people were expecting that. You have to do exactly this at this time and this meal and da, 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 which some people think they want, you know, but then the reality is that's not sustainable for that person. And we know that addiction looks different for everybody. And like you were saying, some people might be able to tolerate grains. Some people might not be able to. And yeah, I think that's one of the biggest challenges I even see with the groups I do is not, and even my own process, not comparing myself to other people. It's like, I still want to look outside of myself for a better food plan. And it's like, no, I got all the information right here. And that's what it kind of sounds like. You were giving, empowering people and giving them the tools to kind of figure that out for themselves. But I think that's really hard for people to accept, because we just want that magic pill or someone to tell me exactly what to do and how to do it. But really, it's figuring it out, what works for us, and then helping those other, yeah, like coping skills and those times that we tend to turn to food, doing other things, like looking at the behaviors of food addiction too, sounds like a big part of this.
Well, and I think that part of looking for that food plan, that quick fix, is just, you know, basically because we've all been infiltrated by diet culture for so long, right? And we've been, you know, to some level traumatized by it and don't trust ourselves. And so trying to teach individuals how to feel empowered, how to trust themselves, how to listen to their body, how to learn how to actually build a relationship with food, you know, which is something that has been their enemy for so long that now, you know, we have to spend it, for most of us, 3 times a day. So let's start to practice this, because if you don't ever spend time with this and learning about what your body likes and how you feel when you eat these foods, you're always going to be seeking for answers outside of yourself. And like you said, we have our answers. We just need sometimes the encouragement to trust them and go with our gut.
Yeah, it's so true with the diet culture really messing that up and that ability to trust yourself. And, you know, our bodies are so wise, but it's so hard to tune into that with all of that, you know, diet culture around us. So I'm so curious, this is so cool that you guys did this. What is some of the like findings that you write about? Cause I don't know if everybody, I'm going to try to track down this paper and read it, but I don't know if everyone's going to go out and do that. Can you give us kind of some of the highlights of, you know, what you kind of found result wise with the groups?
Yeah. And so the paper, something to keep in mind, the paper is based on basically our first groups through. So it doesn't have all the data. And so we're actually in the process, right? We're still collecting data because we collect at 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have all of the data yet. We just finished with our last groups the end of August, that kind of thing. I think Jen and Heidi in the UK as well. And I think Sweden is either in the process of finishing up with their last one or they just have two. So these were initial findings with very few participants. I think we each had like on average something like 30 in that first data set. But Clarissa kind of highlighted a little bit. What we found was that the mental and well-being scale increased the symptoms of food addiction by we used both the Yale food addiction scale, the modified version of it, and then Jen's scale called Craved, those symptoms decreased. And then yes, we did measure, BMI in this study. And I'm not entirely sure why that was included. That was part of the criteria that, you know, we were looking for, but not necessarily, and I say we, because we collected the data, but not necessarily do I understand entirely why we were looking for that, because we know we can't look at somebody and decide, hey, this person's overweight, and so therefore they must have a food addiction. But we did find that BMI did decrease. So those were kind of the main findings. Now in that paper, it's really interesting because Clarissa and I, as the North American team, had the highest dropout rate according to the paper. And we need to dive into that because I think what has happened there is we actually did not have that high of a dropout rate as reported. What we had was a lot of people missed more than two. So they had to participate in 8 of the 10 intervention weeks in order for us to use their data. So we had people who participated in 7 or 6, but they stuck with the group and they're still with the group, but that we couldn't technically continue to use their data. So we didn't actually have that big of a dropout rate as it's reflected in that paper, but certainly it's something we're going to discuss with the team and our statistician, and Clarissa and I will be writing our own paper at some point in order to kind of talk about, you know, just our little group. So that paper that you referenced talks about all three groups as well.
Okay. Yeah. That's good to know and good to clarify. And like, you're right. This is continuing now. Where there's going to be updates as you continue to check in over the progress, because that's the other thing. And I know you two know this all too well. It's interesting to see why some people are able to maintain their abstinence and some people aren't over different lengths of time. And to me, I'm just finding more and more, I just feel so lucky that I'm almost at 5 years, because talking to more and more people, they might've had a full year or even 2 years and then are struggling to get back. So it is like, you know, so interesting, you know, to me and I don't know if you were able to identify any areas, and I'm sure just in the, you know, one-on-one work that you do too, but you know, for people listening, do you see kind of some themes of people that are able to maintain their abstinence versus, you know, people that aren't? I don't know if you see anything that is worthwhile to kind of share with people listening.
Yeah, I think so. And sorry, Clarissa, I'm just going to jump in there. And yeah, okay. So, you know, and this is what I tell people anecdotally, and this is, I've been in the field since 2005. I mean, I've only recently specialized in food in the last 3 years, but talk about any sort of mental health diagnosis, substance use disorder, you know, behavioral or process addiction, you know, anecdotally, the top three reasons people return to use in my experience are death, injury, and illness. The number one factor in people who continue to be quote unquote successful. Now I'm saying this in quotes because, you know, we use this word abstinence. We use this word recovery. We use this word sober. We use these words, these labels. But I want to remind people that those have definitions, you know, to you. You have your own, Siobhan, you have your own definition of abstinence, sobriety, recovery, whatever that might be. I am my own, Clarissa has her own. So the number one thing that I see in people being, again, quote unquote, successful is quality support, not quantity, but quality support. And by that, I mean, we all have allies. We all have our partners in life or our friends or somebody, right, that wants to support us in what we're doing, but they just don't quite get it, right? They're like, oh yeah, okay, you're doing that? Awesome. I won't order the chips and salsa when we go to the Mexican restaurant tonight. Mm-hmm. Amen. We need those people. But then we have people who have walked the walk ahead of us or right now beside us, and we don't have to show up and explain ourselves at all, right? We can go, we can get on a Zoom, we can walk into a physical room, and we can just exist and say whatever it is that's on our heart, on our mind. And we don't have to say, you know, but you know, I can't believe I went back to the store and did it over and over again, or went through 8 drive-thrus and threw it all away and then went home and still ate a dinner and right. And try to make up excuses. People are just nodding their heads and they're like, yeah, we get it. Right. And so that's the quality support that we need. We need to feel not alone, and we need to feel not judged, and we need to have this validation and just a place to be at peace where we can be ourselves and be able to just say, you know what, I did it, I had a cookie, right, or whatever it might be, and know that they're not gonna, oh, now you have to this, that, and the, right, not that there's going to be some punitive response or those allies that can become very you know, they can become disenchanted. We've shown up and we've said, listen, I'm doing this, that, and the other thing again for the 800th time, you know, and then we fall off again, you know, so we do. And that would be what I would say. And Clarissa, you may have a completely different experience, so I would love for you to share that.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree 100% with Molly. I also feel like those individuals who I work with in food addiction and noticed in the clinical trial that can see what these ultra processed foods, sugar, flour really are, right? They reframe it as the drug and not something they're missing out on and can't participate in and, you know, are just going to have to spend their whole life trying not to eat. Like we really, those people who can see recovery as a gift, that it is really allowing us to live our best life. You know, I've worked in drug and alcohol treatment for many years, and the way that food, people with food addiction recover is such a beautiful thing because they get their whole lives back. And, you know, Molly, we've talked about this before. We're not walking around all day worried about slipping back into the food, right? We have to let people believe that recovery is possible. And once they experience it and they get a little quote unquote taste of it, I think that how great they feel is better than any, you know, dopamine response or pleasure or whatever, because by the time they get to us, they're not using food as pleasure anymore. And I think that's this misidea, this misinformation is that we're still enjoying it. No, by the time now, it's not serving us anymore. And so I think for those people who can see the life ahead of them and, you know, really like, okay, what are some amazing recipes that I can do with the food I get to enjoy? How can I celebrate this new holiday? You know, I certainly had a recovery group right on Halloween Day, and people were like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just really, you know, I'm going to have to figure it out. And I was like, you have the choice to make this whatever day you want. Just because the world is eating candy doesn't mean you, what would you do if you had an opportunity to do anything? The most special day, would it be go for a massage and go do this? Like you, we have a choice in this. Let's make some positive decisions for ourselves rather than just, you know, lock myself in my room all night and my husband will answer the door while he gives out the Halloween candy, right?
I've been there.
Yeah. Right? We just have to be able to see that we have a choice in what we get to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to lead in Sandra's class, like an emotional eating class that evening, and everyone was so excited to attend. So I think, yeah, connecting with individuals, finding new ways to celebrate holidays, seeing this as a gift rather than this disease that I have and becoming a victim of it certainly leads to better outcomes. I think for those individuals who can really let go of the weight, the need to know that number on the scale, the weight will release. Right? The longer you continue doing this, it's not about intensity. It's about consistency. It's about avoiding those binges. It's about avoiding those foods, because that real food never made us gain weight. And so, and really just, I think as well, encouraging people that although when we start, right, we may have to have a more, you know, contained low exposure food plan, but that's not to say you have no idea what you'll be able to include in the future, right? We, as the brain heals, you know, people introduce a grain and, oh, it's okay. You know, we want everyone to know that you can be as inclusive as possible. We not go back to the sugar, you know, the ultra processed foods, but that although you may start with a smaller food plan, we just hope it grows and grows over time. And you feel like the opportunity is unlimited in recovery.
And to that point though, I think too, like sometimes, so like even just thinking about our own experiences with these groups, right? I think sometimes people, the level of intervention did not match the level of severity of, right, how far the substance use disorder, addiction, whatever we want to label it, had progressed, right? So all of this is well and good. And I agree. And for whom it's worked for, it's worked, right? And that's true of anything. It's true of any diet, of any, you know, belief system, whatever, who it works for is who it works for. But I think too, that when, so like I had said, that death, injury, illness, those are the top reasons I've seen that people return to use. But I think the reason, you know, we know that it's 33, 33, 33. It's something like 33% of people can stop, put it down, whatever. Maybe they've read a book, they've watched a movie, somebody has said, I'm concerned about your drinking or your eating, right? And they're like, okay, let me take a look at that. I'm going to do like, you know, I don't know, dry July or something, right? And give it a shot. And they're like, you know what? I never need to pick that up again. Then there's 33% of people that will get on, get off until they're off, right? And we hear Molly Carmel tell her story about, you know, she had to do it for how many ever years, I think like 20 years or something. I don't know. I'm probably misquoting, but like it was quite a few years to get, you know, the number of years she has now, right? And then we have those folks that fall into the final 33% that will continue to use, do the behavior, whatever it is, until they have died or have some sort of severe consequence where they're like in a controlled environment. And only then will it stop. And, you know, these statistics have been around for a very long time and I don't think they've changed much. You know, and so to keep in mind that sometimes that on off that middle 33% is possible that, and we knew this going into that our intervention would not be enough for some people, right? So if you find or feel like you fall more on the severe end of things, you may not be able to be as inclusive as Clarissa and I would love for everybody to be, right? And so we also have to keep that in mind. We couldn't treat, right? Like we had to pick some sort of middle ground as to where we were going to show up for people. So like our program, you know, or the study that we did, really, I think we found more mild to moderate, maybe on the severe end of things. But the severe people who did stick around, right, they may not have had 100% total abstinence, but there was probably harm reduction, right? And things like that. So, I mean, I think it's just important to know too, like for anybody who's listening, you have to find an intervention that matches your need. And if what you're doing is not working, it may not be because that thing is wrong so much as it just may not be enough. And that's why we were originally designing that IOP program, because IOP is 10 hours a week, not 10 hours over 10 weeks. It's 10 hours a week of treatment, right? So we know that that need is there. And certainly we still hope to develop that. You know, now we've gotten involved in all this other stuff. So it's coming, right? But to find that, and you can find, so you can find those inpatient, you can find residential programs, right? And you can do it a week at CORE or SHIFT. You can do it for 30, 60, 90 days at a place like SunCloud Health in Chicago or Milestones in Recovery in Florida, right? But then it's like, you really don't have much in between those things. You know, then you have coaches and those kinds of people who will do group, maybe they show up and do one-on-one. But if you need that level of intensity that requires an inpatient or an intensive outpatient treatment and we're showing up, it's better than nothing, but it's like giving somebody the wrong antibiotic, right? It's not strong enough. So it's helping a bit, but that infection is just still raging. And I'm still getting sicker. And now I feel like there's something broken and wrong with me. So I just want to throw that out there too, that, you know, make sure that you reach out and ask like, hey, this, I feel like before you just ghost whoever it is you're working with, like, is there more that I could be doing? I have clients I meet 3 times a week. It may be 30 minutes a time, but sometimes that's what they need, right? And again, that may still not be enough, but it's something more than, hey, once a week for an hour or once a week for half an hour or once every couple of weeks, whatever it might be. So I just wanted to throw that out there too, because we did see that as well. And we knew that going in, we predicted that going in, that it would not be enough for some people, but we did our best to try to keep them connected to the group, but also you may need, you know, letting them know, like you may need something more.
Thank you so much for clarifying that. Cause I think that is so critical what you're just saying. Thank you so much. And yeah, for people listening, that the need might be more than what they are currently, like there's still hope, there's still treatment. It's finding the one that fits like your severity, like you're saying. So yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. And probably was really frustrating and hard for you guys too, knowing that, yeah, you're helping, but maybe wishing you could even do more. So I'm so glad that you're still going to be creating that intensive outpatient program at some point. And now though, I think, so is this sweet sobriety, because it's the first I'm hearing of that, is that kind of born out of this? Because this, you know, the IOP is on the back burner. And then how did that kind of come about, I guess? I'm guessing from these groups and, you know, seeing the need, but talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So we had originally, you know, had these modules, and so we just basically amped them all up, and now they are far more like clinically intensive than what they were. And there's a lot more modules or sections to each, and homework. And so as well, people can purchase those. They can do it on their own. They'll be able to purchase them, do it in a group setting as well. We're starting, so November 14th, we're kind of doing our VIP, where we're just going to kind of test this online food addiction community, but we want it to be as inclusive as possible. Either someone who maybe identifies with maybe having an eating disorder and food addiction, or maybe only food addiction, or maybe I'm not even sure what I identify with. Maybe I'm just looking for harm reduction. Whatever that is, we want to be able to show people that you can radically change your relationship with food. And no matter where you are, we're going to love and support you through it. And there's no judgment. It's really just going to be a place where we are going to lift you up. And so we're going to run 5 groups a week. There's a workshop that's starting on November 16th called Surviving the Holidays. And that will include, you know, again, a video with some psychoeducation, some tools, and then a live group that will happen for participants who are taking it. And the goal being that we just want to help create a community. And we know in America, it's that push time where it's Thanksgiving and then food celebration until January. So we wanted to be able to give people some tools. But the biggest thing we really wanted to do with this community was not have this barrier of cost. And this we see in a lot of food addiction programs that are out there right now. So our workshops are not going to be more than $50. And, you know, community, we haven't decided on the exact price yet, but it's not going to be more than $25 a month. And that's giving you 5 groups a week. So that could be, you know, up to 30 groups. And we really just want to make it accessible, and you're not having to commit for a year at a time, because we know how recovery is, right? And I also know, like, I often get people who will want to sign up and with me to work individually. And, you know, they're like, oh, let me pay for 10 sessions. And I'm like, no. Paying for 10 sessions is not going to get you recovery. I want you to, when you want a session, you let me know and we will work on your schedule. And this makes them participate, right, in their recovery and fight for their recovery. And if they have a slip, they're like, oh yeah, you know, I want to schedule a session. I want to go over this. And so again, we just want people to be able to say, hey, this is helping me, not, oh, now I purchase in, I'm stuck in this. And so within this community, they can also get one-to-one coaching. We're working with Bethany and Jennifer. So it's the 4 of us. And yeah, we're just going to be continually, you know, updating, providing new workshops, providing new psychoeducation. And Molly and I are continuing to do training, ongoing training. We're going to train with Kim Dennis next week. She has an eating disorder, food addiction, SunCloud Health. And so we're learning as much as we can to help support the community as much as we can. We also just recently completed an embodiment practice course. So we'd love to do some more work around that. And yeah, just really identifying all aspects of addiction, you know, the perfectionism, just running workshops on topics that are really going to speak to those of us in, you know, that have gone through recovery and some of the best practices that are already informed from addiction treatment that, you know, we've already followed in the first place.
I love this. And there's definitely, like, I think a need for something like this right now too. I always say now is such a good time to be a sugar addict because there's so much more support out there, I think, than there ever was. Almost can match that every single level. Like, we're getting there. And this is just another option for people, especially because I know cost is a barrier, you know, for a lot of people. And so this sounds like a really great way and very comprehensive, again, very inclusive, you know, kind of back to, you know, what makes people stay abstinent. Molly, you were kind of saying that, you know, connection. And I think it's feeling understood, like in a way that only other addicts can understand you. You know, I always say if someone can be like, yeah, I also used to take food out of the trash. I mean, that's just like the special person, you know, that can kind of get it and you feel that support, not the judgment, like we were also saying, because I know other people have come to my groups with from really strict, maybe 12-step programs where it was like, you one mess up and you got to start all over again. So, and that works for some, just didn't work for me. So I love that this is much more gentle, loving, uplifting, not punitive, like, you know, so, and taking all of the, I'm just like amazed about all of the different education components you both have, like, and just continuing to add and tweak, you know, this community is really going to benefit from that. But I'm sure you have too, I bet, in your own, I'm sure it's just helped your own recovery so much. I think that's, you know, something I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, people like us that are you know, in recovery, but coaching other people, like we still are in recovery, you know, ourselves. So helping people, doing like you guys do your podcast too. That's like what helps me continue to grow and learn and be accountable. And as you are continuing to educate yourselves, I can't even imagine what a gift that is to both of your own recoveries. So I love that so much. And just back to, you mentioned that Bethany and Jennifer are also a part of this. I don't know those names. So maybe just a quick, just for people. And then how, like, because this is going to air November the 9th. So people are going to be listening like, okay, this sounds great. How do we sign up? So give us a few more of those details.
Yeah. So Bethany Mazaru, I'm hoping I'm saying her name correctly. All right. Clarissa's giving me the thumbs up, joined us. And Jennifer Trainer Bradley, they both took they went through our study with us. We couldn't use their data, but they were already in the field in some way or had a background. So, Clarissa and I mean, again, that's kind of like important is probably the wrong word, but certainly it's a distinction that we have in the field that I am a dual licensed mental health and addiction counselor. Clarissa is a registered social worker with certifications in substance use disorders, mental health, that kind of thing. And so when we were looking for people that we wanted to, you know, supervise or join us, we were looking for people with similar backgrounds. And so Bethany is also a registered social worker in Ontario. And then Jennifer has a master's in social work as well. And she's also here in the US. And so they took the initial thing as participants, the initial sweet sobriety, we'll call it, as participants. And then they joined us in our last, in this last group that we just did, where we were running four groups at one time. They joined us as co-facilitators, and they even facilitated a couple of the process groups. And so now, for example, our Surviving the Holidays, workshop is Bethany's. It's her design. It's her content, all of that. So she will be the facilitator of that. Jennifer is creating one for December. Bethany, I think, has one in the works for January. I think Clarissa is going to take over in February. So we really just wanted people that they have master's degrees. They have, right, this education level that then, and these ethics and standards that we have to adhere to because of those licenses. So I'm required 20 to 40 hours continuing education every year to maintain my licensure. So, you know, you were saying like, oh, like this has probably benefited me. And I'm like, well, yeah, but I did it selfishly first. Right. So like I went and I'm continuing my training in solution focused brief therapy first, because it's selfishly, it is for me first. And then I want to share it. The embodiment course, selfishly for me first. And then I want to share it. Going to Kim's, you know, selfishly for me first, I want to share. But you know, again, like we're required these kinds of things. And I think it just holds, we just have higher expectations of ourselves and our program because of it. And we hold ourselves to that. So they're wonderful. And I'm so happy to have them along. It's really exciting. And I think they have a lot to share with the world. So how do people find us? Sweetsobriety.ca, all one word. That's our website. They can go there and they can register for the workshop. The membership services will not be available yet because, as Clarissa said, that will launch November 14th. But yes, they can go and sign up for that workshop with Bethany and they can kind of check out a little bit what's there. There's not much there because we're doing that on purpose right now, keeping some stuff back. But certainly we want to introduce ourselves to the bigger world with this workshop. And then there will be a VIP invitation for pre-launch, of the Sweet Sobriety program, this membership program. So yeah, so sweetsobriety.ca. They can also come to the foodjunkiespodcast.com. So it's not the food junkie, it's foodjunkiespodcast.com, or, you know, find us. And we have a link there to our website as well. So that folks can find us easily that way. So, and we talk about it in our intros and stuff. So if anybody listens to the podcast, they'll get more information there as well.
I love this and such great. I'm so glad the timing, because we've been trying to juggle our schedule to make this podcast happen. And I think the timing's going to be perfect again. So people can go out and I'll make sure I link the website and they can sign up, because yeah, surviving the holidays. That is, we just got through Halloween. You know, like Clarissa, like you mentioned, having that mindset is so critical. Like and looking at it with different, well, how can I make this, you know, even better than it was before? Because let's face it, you know, at Halloween, I used to like eat all the candy and then wake up feeling terrible like the next day. And when you were just talking about Halloween, I realized it just went this year. I didn't really even think about it, to be honest. I really did not think about it at all, which is so freeing. Again, when you think about where before it used to be such a white knuckled night and so much guilt and shame and all the things. So I think the timing of all this is really, really amazing. And I want to just talk to you about, you were just saying about Molly, about the education, like your credentials. This is the other thing, the knowledge that you two bring, obviously, is your backgrounds, not just in the food, but other substance use. You know, like, I think that's really unique as well. So you have the full picture and really the experience dealing with all types of addiction. So I think that's also really like kind of important for people to understand. And then both of you in recovery yourself. I just think that's such a gift too, because you walk the walk, you understand it, you know, not just from like your clinician brains, but from, you know, and I think that's like such a gift for people. So yeah, I love it. Well, we are out of time, but I would like if you each maybe just take like a minute or two, maybe any closing thoughts or, you know, words of wisdom to leave today, or anything else maybe about the study that we didn't get to that you wanted to mention. So I'll call on Clarissa first, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, I just want to let anybody who's listening know that this food addiction recovery is hard. Right? It is, we don't have the negative consequence. They may be longer, they may be progressive over time, but we don't eat a piece of candy and go to jail. We don't, you know, eat that bagel and then, you know, lose our license like you would with like a DUI. And so it makes recovery from this a lot more challenging. But once you get there, it is just the most amazing. And like, you know, Siobhan said, you can go through these holidays and I don't even think about it anymore. You know, I used to see all the candy in the stores before the month before, because that's when it gets out there. I don't even see it anymore. It's not a focus at all anymore. And I also just, you know, really want, when we think about this myth of moderation, I just want to say to people, like, honestly, if we just discovered sugar today and we found out it's going to cause diabetes, Alzheimer's, obesity, addiction, heart disease, like nobody would consume it. Nobody would consume it. We certainly wouldn't give it to our children. We wouldn't be handing it out on Halloween. And if we just have to understand and be compassionate with ourselves that we are dealing with years and years of culture around this being acceptable. And there will come a time when what we're doing is the new norm. And I just like it's changing. Times are changing. Studies are coming out. We see from how quickly the study here went viral because people are seeking this. They are needing solutions to problems they can't fix without changing the food. So yeah, it just anybody who is, you know, in that 33%, who still just keep trying, you know, I say, you know, we talked about that, be the chronic never giver upper, because there will be a time when it will stick.
Love that. Thank you.
I think I would just say to anybody listening, again, whether you know, it doesn't matter to me if you work with us, here's what I want for everybody. If you need help, and you're asking for it, I just want you to get it. So still feel free, reach out to Siobhan, ask her about her services. You know, the thing that you bring that's unique to the field is like the emotion code, the body code stuff. Like, you just take it from a wholly different approach than I do. And I don't think that I could ever do that. Right. So find those professionals that show up and meet your needs. Right. I can have plenty of ideas about what I think your needs are, but only you really know what they are. Right. Find the person that's going to help you meet your needs or gets you started in some direction. Ask for help. Maybe it's not me, but call Clarissa or myself. We're happy to have a 30-minute consultation with you for free and point you in whatever direction, right? We're probably going to suggest, hey, like sweet sobriety might be for you if we think it's a good fit, but we also might say like, you might want to give Cora a call. Or, hey, you know, Siobhan does this thing with emotion code and can really get at, you know, trauma or stuff held in the body that like we just can't process verbally with you, which is what we do, right, with our work. So, you know, again, I think it's just, if you need help, please just ask. You don't have to, please don't feel like you have to ask the right person the first time. Just start asking questions and, you know, I'm happy to get you pointed in whatever direction works for you, whatever that might be, because for so long, like you said, Siobhan, for so long, we walked this road alone. We didn't know, right? We didn't know. And now there are just so many more options today. I mean, it's overwhelming, right? We hear that all the time. It's like, so-and-so says to do this and so-and-so says to do that, or this program wants me to, right? Like, which is fantastic, but also very overwhelming. So, you know, if you need a guiding light just to walk beside you, even just to make that decision, Clarissa and I are also here for you for that. So I just want to leave you guys with that. So I just appreciate this time here with you today, Siobhan. Thank you so much for having us back.
Thank you so much. And thanks so much for the work that you are doing and will continue to do. I know I just really appreciate it, even personally, for the changes, Clarissa, that you're talking about. That's going to, you know, come one day where it's like, used to give sugar to kids. That's crazy. So I am so excited for that future. So thank you both today. And I will make sure to link how to get in touch with you. And I will add your information to, especially the Sweet Sobriety, to my resources page on my website for people as well. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Siobhan, for having us.
Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day. And remember, life is so much sweeter without sugar.